I'm Brad Beenow. I'm a pastor in La Jolla, California, which is near San Diego. I have been at Holden three times previously. The first was 1979, and it was during that stay that I really began to commit some of Robert Frost's poetry to memory. I have to thank for my love for Frost one of my seminary professors, William Brower, who taught at Princeton Seminary where I went to school. Showed me a lot of possibilities with Robert Frost, especially how to perhaps do Frost in an oral sort of way. Frost is wonderful to read, but I think in many ways even better to hear. I'll be saying some things about Frost's life and about the poems tonight, but mostly I hope just to let the poetry speak for itself and just let that wash over us and soak it up. I'll be glad to talk later tomorrow. I'm here until a week from tomorrow, so we can certainly talk about this poetry if you'd like to. Frost is an interesting person, but for many reasons that most of us don't get around to knowing about or thinking about. We think of him most closely associated with New England, and indeed he lived there in New Hampshire for a good while. But actually he was born on the West Coast, born in San Francisco area, lived a good bit of his adult life in Old England, as he called it, said that in some ways he felt he had to go back to Old England in order to understand New England, and he really wrote his first two, I think, books of published poetry while he was in England, and then came back to have them published in the United States, and that was when he really began to receive critical acclaim. This first poem that I want to do is called The Pasture. It's a rather short poem, and I think it serves well as an introduction. It's a kind of invitation into the world of Robert Frost. Frost himself used it as the introductory poem for every book of poetry that he wrote, except the first one. But after that, it introduced every volume. He wrote it in a way for his wife. It's kind of a love poem, an invitation to share a simple but tender moment. And my wife, Anne, is here, so think of you always. It's called The Pasture. I'm going out to clean the pasture spring. I'll only stop to rake the leaves away and wait to watch the water clear, I may. I shan't be gone long. You come too. I'm going out to fetch the little calf that's standing by the mother. It's so young it totters when she licks it with her tongue. I shan't be gone long. You come too. So, with that invitation, we jump into the world of Robert Frost. Frost was not a particularly overtly religious person, although you'll find some religious imagery certainly in his poems. He was a kind of a private person, I guess, when it came to religion. I don't know as he had any particular denominational affiliation, but here's the next little poem with a real theological truth to it, although twisted with a nice bit of Frost's humor. It's called Not All There. I think this can often describe our human experience. It's called Not All There. I turn to speak to God about the world's despair. To make bad matters worse, I found God wasn't there. God turned to speak to me. Don't anybody laugh, God found I wasn't there, at least not over half. Ethics. Next poem is about ethics. It's called There Are Roughly Zones. Now this is interesting to me because Frost was a really rather conservative person. And he did have some very fixed views about the way things ought to be done and the way people ought to behave, but this poem has a nice touch in it of saying there are, as he says, there are no fixed lines between wrong and right, but there are roughly zones whose laws must be obeyed. He's talking about a tree that has been brought far into New England, and he's wondering about, you know, did we really bring it too far? It's a peach tree. And is it going to survive the winter? And this poor tree may have to blame this trait that human beings have not to respect the zones that need to be regarded. There are roughly zones. We sit indoors and talk of the cold outside, and every gust that gathers strength and heaves is a threat to the house, but the house has long been tried. We think of the tree. If it never again has leaves, we'll know, we say, that this was the night it died. It is very far north, we admit, to have brought the peach. What is it that comes over a man? Is it soul or mind that to no limits or bounds he can stay confined? You would say his ambition was to extend the reach clear to the Arctic of every living kind. Why is his nature forever so hard to teach that though there is no fixed line between wrong and right, there are roughly zones whose laws must be obeyed? There is nothing much we can do for the tree tonight. But we can't help feeling more than a little betrayed that the northwest wind should rise to such a height just when the cold went down so many below. The tree has no leaves and may never have them again. We must wait till some months hence in the spring to know. But if it is destined never again to grow, it can blame this limitless trait in the hearts of men. Now, make no particular apologies for the fact that Robert Frost did not use inclusive language. He just didn't, and so we'll honor him by doing the poems the way they were written, but hope that that can be heard in a way that still has meaning for us. The next poem is about, again, a particular time of year, even as there are roughly zones, get you a clear picture of what a New England winter is like there. Now, think a little farther ahead, a month or two into the springtime. This time of year that in New England at least, and probably here at Holden Village too, they refer to as mud time. You know, it's not spring, but the thaw is happening, and it's just generally a mess. The poem is called Two Tramps in Mud Time. It's a poem, I think, really about vocation. As he says, vocation and avocation. A sense of calling. What is one's purpose in life? It's called Two Tramps in Mud Time. Out of the woods, two strangers came and caught me splitting wood in the yard. And one of them put me off by aim by hailing cheerily, "Hit them hard!" I knew pretty well what he had in mind, why he let the other go on away. He wanted to take my job for pay. Good blocks of oak it was I split, as large around as the chopping block. And every piece I squarely hit fell splinterless as a cloven rock. The blows that a life of self-control spares to strike for the common good, that day, giving a loose to my soul, I spent on the unimportant wood. The sun was out, but the wind was chill. You know how it is on an April day when the sun is warm and the wind is still. You're 1 month on in the middle of May. But if you so much as dare to speak, a cloud comes over the sunlit arch, a wind comes off the frozen peak, and you're 2 months back in the middle of March. A bluebird comes tenderly up to alight and turns to the wind to unruffle a plume. His song so pitched so as not to excite a single flower, as yet, to bloom. It is snowing a flake, and he half knew winter was only playing possum, except in color. He isn't blue, and he wouldn't advise a thing to blossom. The water for which we may have to look in the summertime with a witching wand, in every wheel rut is now a brook, in every print of hoof a pond. Be glad of water, but don't forget the lurking frost in the earth beneath that will come forth after the sun is set and show on the water its crystal teeth. Now, the time when most I loved my task, these two must make me love it more by coming with what they came to ask. You'd think I'd never felt before the weight of an axe head poised aloft, the grip on earth of outspread feet, the life of muscles rocking soft and smooth and moist in vernal heat. Out of the mud, two hulking tramps from sleeping God knows where last night, but not long since in the lumber camps. They thought all chopping was theirs of right, men of the woods and lumberjacks. They judged me by their appropriate tool. Except as a fellow handled an axe, they had no way of knowing a fool. Nothing on either side was said. They knew they had but to stay their stay, and all their logic would fill my head as that I had no right to play at what was another man's work for gain. My right might be love, but theirs was need. And where the two exist in twain, theirs was the better right, agreed. But yield who will to their separation. My object in living is to unite my avocation and my vocation as my two eyes make one in sight. Only where love and need are one, and the work is play for mortal stakes, is the deed ever really done for heaven and the future's sakes. We'll push a little farther now into the seasons. Winter to spring to late spring. Here's a poem called Hyla Brook. Hyla is a reference to a breed of frogs, the Hyla frogs, and in this brook was where these frogs seemed to breed and to congregate, and so it became known as the Hyla Brook. Well, let me do the poem first and then say a few things about it. Hyla Brook. By June, our brooks run out of song and speed. Sought for much after that, it will be found either to have gone groping underground and taken with it all the Hyla breed that shouted in the mist a month ago like ghost of sleigh bells in a ghost of snow, or to have flourished and come up in jewel weed, weak foliage that is blown upon and bent even against the way the waters went. Its bed is left a faded paper sheet of dead leaves, stuck together by the heat. A brook to none but who remember long. This, as it will be seen, is other far than with brooks other taken otherwhere in song. We love the things we love for what they are. Now, I think that here's a poem that really shows some of Frost's genius as a poet. There is no particular meter, there is no particular rhyme scheme, and yet I did not find that a very difficult poem to commit to memory. It flows. It just babbles along like a brook sounds. This, as it will be seen, is other far than with brooks taken otherwhere in song. I mean, it just sounds like a brook sounds. And that wonderful last line, we love the things we love for what they are. Not for what they aren't, but for what they are. I think especially in ministry that I've done with older adults, it's important to keep that in mind, that you have a long memory and that you can see people for what they are. Not for what they no longer are or aren't today, but what we essentially are. My wife likes to say that as we get older and older, we become more like ourselves. Which I don't know, some days I feel like in my case may not be very good news, I don't know. But to love the things that we love for what they are and not be distracted by what they aren't is a wonderful thing. Well, to the lighter side of Frost here for a moment. As I say, he was born in San Francisco, and even though his father, as I said, he was a rather conservative, undoubtedly Republican person. His father was a Democrat, politically active, and in his younger years, Frost was hauled around to these political meetings in the back rooms of saloons and taverns and wherever, with probably some shady characters cutting deals and so forth. And I like to think that this next poem came out of some early reflections on that, those sorts of experiences. It's called Endive's Dive. Now, if you know the New Testament parable of the Dives and Lazarus, that puts this a little in context. you have to, this is very much unlike the image of Robert Frost that you may have of the great nature poet, you know, out there among the birch trees. Now, consider him now in Dives' Dive. It is late at night, and still I am losing, but still I am steady and unaccusing. As long as the Declaration guards my right to be equal in number of cards, it is nothing to me who owns this dive. Let's have a look at another five. Yeah. Kind of see him there with his green visor, you know, pulled down, dealing out. Frost died in 1963 and wrote a good amount of his poetry in the beginning in the 20s and the 30s and then right on through. But in a way, I think we could almost say he predates modern America. If you'd really date the technological revolution and the explosion of media and so forth as happening sometime in the 60s, Frost, I think, touches chords for us that come from a prior era, and there is certainly a longing in most of us to recapture what was good about that and bring it forward along with the good things that we experience in this day and age too. But this next poem, I know that he wasn't thinking of television when he wrote this, but it just makes me think that if he were around today and saw how we inoculate ourselves with the tube, this might have applied. It's called Neither Out Far Nor In Deep. He's talking about what people do when they're at the shore, looking at the ocean. But I submit he could equally be talking about how people view their television set. Neither out far nor in deep. The people along the sand all turn and look one way. They turn their backs on the land. They look at the sea all day. As long as it takes to pass, a ship keeps raising its hull. And the wetter sand, like glass, reflects a standing gull. The land may vary more, but whatever the case may be, the water comes ashore, and the people look at the sea. They cannot look out far, they cannot look in deep, but when was that ever a bar to any watch they keep? Now, if you've been at the shore, you know, observe this. Where we're from in San Diego, you know, it's very common. People are fascinated by the waves, but you really cannot see out very far. And at least in San Diego, you certainly can't see in very deeply either. All kinds of interesting things going on the land behind you, you know. But we're fascinated by this. It's very much how I think we use television. You know, real life is infinitely more interesting, but you get fixated on this, you know, small image in front of you. Frost is often referred to as a nature poet, an appellation which he detested and did not like at all. If you listen carefully and read carefully Frost's poetry, I dare say you'll find almost no poems that do not have some human referent in them. Not always human beings, but he endows all sorts of things with human characteristics. He was very much a people person and a very astute observer of human nature. This next poem is called A Considerable Speck, and dedicated to any of us who have ever been teachers and have had to grade papers. You'll understand that by the time we get to the end of the poem, the last stanza. This is also a very good example, I think, of how Frost carries us along with a nice image story and then sums it all up in a nice tight bundle with a particular point right at the end. It's called A Considerable Speck. A speck that would have been beneath my sight on any but a paper sheet so white set off across what I had written there. And I had idly poised my pen in air to stop it with a period of ink when something strange about it made me think, well, this was no dust speck by my breathing blown, but unmistakably a living mite with inclinations it could call its own. It paused as with suspicion of my pen, and then came racing wildly on again to where my manuscript was not yet dry, and paused again, and either drank or smelt with loathing, for again it turned to fly. It seemed too tiny to have room for feet, yet must have had a set of them complete to express how much it didn't want to die. It ran with terror and with cunning crept. It faltered. I could see it hesitate. And then, in the middle of the open sheet, cower down in desperation to accept whatever I accorded it of fate. I have none of the tenderer-than-thou collectivistic regimenting love with which the modern world is being swept. But this poor microscopic item now, since it was nothing I knew evil of, I let it lie there till I hope it slept. I have a mind myself, and recognize mind when I meet with it in any guise. No one can know how glad I am to find on any sheet the least display of mind. Frost had his ways of getting in his subtle digs at colleagues and so forth. In his time, he was often criticized by people who were pushing into new areas and new frontiers of poetry, experimenting with free verse and blank verse and new forms and so forth. And they would often chide him because of his adherence. I mean, his need to write with rhyme and meter. His retort to that, I mean, obviously reflected a bit in this poem, was, you know, you people can do your free verse whatever you want. He says, to me, that's like playing tennis with the net down. What's the challenge, you know? He says, I want to write and accept the challenge of making things fit. And this next poem is a wonderful example of how he's able to do that. Someone, I don't remember where I read this, has said that this may be the most perfectly formulated poem in the English language. Now you can decide that for yourself. It's called Fire and Ice, one of the more well-known of Frost poems. And the other night when Jonathan Ferrix was doing his slide presentation on Kilimanjaro, I don't know if any of you were here and saw that, he commented about how fire and ice, these two elemental things in creation, work to, you know, to build up and to tear down. And that's very evident on Kilimanjaro, where, you know, the volcanoes have lifted up this incredible 19,000-foot mountain. And then it's so high, the glaciers form on top and slowly begin to wear it down. Well, Frost is asking us to consider, I think, at an emotional level, how fire and ice operate. I think to suggest that you can ruin it in one of two ways. You can be inflamed by your passions, or you can simply be cold in your indifference. If you want to ruin the human experience, either way will do fine, he seems to say. But choose your weapon, fire and ice. Some say the world will end in fire, some say in ice. From what I've tasted of desire, I'd hold with those who favor fire. But if it had to perish twice, I think I know enough of hate to say that for destruction, ice is also great and would suffice. Well, Frost became, especially in his later years, a great goodwill ambassador for the United States, traveled much around the world. Some have suggested that if this country ever really appointed a poet laureate, it might indeed be Robert Frost. This next poem is called Departmental. I don't think he wrote it on the occasion of going to the Soviet Union, but he did do this poem there, and I think found a way to make a little subtle jibe at the bureaucracy that he found in the communist system there. Certainly not not reserved alone for the communist bureaucracy. We can all identify with this. But it's called departmental. I think it, let's see, this used to have also a subtitle he gave to it called The Death of My Aunt Jerry. And this is Aunt, A-N-T. This again is a poem about insects, but again, when you get to the end, you'll see that he's really driving toward a point. Departmental. An ant on the tablecloth ran into a dormant moth of many times his size. He showed not the least surprise. His business wasn't with such. He gave it scarcely a touch and was off on his duty run. Yet, if he encountered one of the hive's inquiry squad, whose work it is to find out God and the nature of time and space, he would put him onto the case. Ants are a curious race. One crossing with hurried tread the body of one of its dead isn't given a moment's arrest, seems not even impressed. Yet he no doubt reports to any with whom he crosses antennae, and they no doubt report to the higher-ups at court. Then the word goes forth in formic, death's come to Jerry McCormick. Our selfless forager, Jerry, will the special janissary whose office it is to bury the dead of the commissary go bring him home to his people. Lay him in state on a sepal, wrap him for shroud in a petal, embalm him with ichor of nettle. This is the word of your queen. And presently on the scene appears a solemn mortician. And taking formal position with feelers calmly a twiddle, he seizes the dead by the middle and heaving him high in the air, carries him out of there. No one stands round to stare. It's no one else's affair. It couldn't be called ungentle, but how thoroughly departmental. There's another insight in that poem, I think, to some of the genius of Robert Frost. The way that this man could work a rhyme is something truly to behold. I mean, will the special janissary, whose office it is to bury the dead of the commissary, are not your garden variety rhyming words. I mean, this takes some thought to get that framed up just so. Well, back into a little more of the emotional depth of Frost. A very brief poem here called Lodged. I think this poem is one of the best examples of what empathy is all about. This need to feel with the feelings of someone else. Again, here's a poem. No human beings in this poem. It's about flowers and wind and rain and so forth. And yet, unmistakably, you are in touch with deep human emotions in this very brief poem called Lodged. The rain to the wind said, "You push and I'll pelt." And they so smote the garden bed that the flowers actually knelt and lay there, lodged, though not dead. I know how the flowers felt. Well, on to, I think, my favorite poem of Robert Frost's, in part because he mentions baseball in it, but for other reasons too. Birches. You have to think now, think hard for a minute about birch trees. Most of us, I'm sure, have seen them. Some are ramrod straight, of course, but many, I'm sure you've observed, are bent over, drooping. I mean, their leaves are hanging down on the... Now, I don't know how they actually get that way, and the point of this poem is not a scientific investigation. This is poetry in its finest sense here. Frost is looking at this and musing and saying, how do those trees get that way? And he's thinking, it's almost like someone had climbed to the top, you know, and had swung them back and forth and bent them around and slowly took the stiffness out of them, as he says in the poem, until they just hung limp. And then he begins to reflect on, metaphorically, what does that mean to have that joy of doing something as just fun-loving as swinging a birch tree? Not that I've ever seen anybody do this, although I must admit, you know, when I've been around birch trees, the desire has been there to try this and see if you could actually get them to do that. I don't know. But that's the framework for the poem, birches. When I see birches bend to left and right across the lines of straighter, darker trees, I like to think some boy's been swinging them. But swinging doesn't bend them down to stay, as ice storms do. Often you must have seen them loaded with ice a sunny winter morning after a rain. They click together as the breeze rises and turn many colored as the stir cracks and crazes their enamel. Soon the sun's warmth makes them shed crystal shells, shattering and avalanching on the snow crust, such heaps of broken glass to sweep away. You'd think the inner dome of heaven had fallen. They are dragged to the withered bracken by the load, and they seem not to break, though once bowed so low for long, they never right themselves. You may see their trunks arching forward in the woods years afterwards, trailing their leaves on the ground like girls on hands and knees that throw their hair before them over their head to dry in the sun. But I was about to say, when Truth broke in with all her matter of fact about the ice storm, that I should prefer to have some boy bend them. As he went out and in to fetch the cows, some boy too far from town to learn baseball, whose only play was what he found himself and could play alone. One by one, he subdued his father's trees by riding them down over and over again until he took the stiffness out of them. And not one but hung limp. Not one was left for him to conquer. He learned all there was for him to learn about not launching out too soon and so not carrying the tree away clear to the ground. He always kept his poise, climbing to the top with the same pains you use to fill a cup, up to the brim, and even above the brim. And then he flung outward, feet first with a swish, kicking his way down through the air to the ground. So was I once myself a swinger of birches. And so I dream of going back to be. It's when I'm weary of considerations, and life is too much like a pathless wood where your face burns and tickles from the cobwebs having broken across it, and one eye is weeping from a twig having lashed across it open. I'd like to get away from earth a while, and then come back to it and begin over. May no fate willfully misunderstand me and half grant what I wish and whisk me away not to return. Earth's the right place for love. I can't imagine where it's likely to go better. I'd like to go by climbing a birch tree. Climb black branches up a snow-white trunk till the tree could bear no more, but dipped its top and set me down again. That would be good, both going and coming back. One could do worse than be a swinger of birches. It's an interesting reflection, you know, to think back from later in life to that innocence of youth. Some have speculated, you know, those lines at the end of the poem where he says, I'd like to go by climbing a birch tree, climb black branches up a snow-white trunk. If you think about it, that's almost what you see when you look at the lines of poetry on the printed page. black branches, as it were, across the page, up the snow-white trunk of the page. You know, I want to climb this poetry to reach whatever heights it can take me to, and then let it just gently bring me back to earth. I mean, I never want to get fully away from the here and now. No place is love likely to go better. Well, as much as Frost loved the beauty of the moment, he knew as well as any that you can't keep that, you can't bottle that, you can't live in the glory of the moment always. This poem is called "Nothing Gold Can Stay," as if to say, you know, when you have those wonderful, clear moments in life, you just enjoy them because they will pass. Nothing gold can stay. Nature's first green is gold, her hardest hue to hold. Her first leaf's a flower, but only for an hour. Then leaf subsides to leaf. So Eden sank in grief. So dawn goes down to day. Nothing gold can stay. So enjoy it while you have it. Now then, Frost is a true poet because he can have it always. Even as he has just said, you can't take it with you, you know, enjoy it while you have it. Now here comes a poem called "Provide, Provide," with exactly the opposite advice, which is you can take it with you. I always think of this poem in the context of Jesus' parable in Luke 16 about the dishonest steward. You may remember, the man who feathers his own nest by cutting deals with his boss's creditors so that even his boss has to concede that, yes, he has been a rather shrewd collaborator here. Anne and I are going to be doing some sessions on parables, and we'll be talking about that one on Saturday morning, I guess it is. This poem came out of a real-life experience when Frost was in Boston, when there was a strike going on among the city workers. And those people, like the folks who came to do the janitorial work, he reflected on, you know, what their plight in life was going to be. Now, in order to get the point of one of the early stanzas here, it's helpful if you know who the biblical character of Abishag was. Here's the Old Testament. Where's our biblical scholars? No, they're not here. Does anyone know who Abishag was, this character, this woman in the Old Testament? No one. Someone. Anyone. No one. Okay. In the story of King David, at the end of his life, as he's old and feeble and frail and on his deathbed, and as the story tells it, very cold, the search goes out for the most beautiful woman in the kingdom, whose name is Abishag, as they find her. And she is brought in to comfort and to warm King David on his deathbed. Medicinal purposes only, of course. So you need to know who Abishag is, the beautiful, most fair person in all of the kingdom. Okay. The poem is "Provide, Provide." The witch that came, the withered hag, to wash the steps with pail and rag, was once the beauty Abishag, the picture pride of Hollywood. Too many fall from great and good for you to doubt the likelihood. Die early and avoid the fate. Or if predestined to die late, make up your mind to die in state. Make the whole stock exchange your own. If need be, occupy a throne where nobody can call you crone. Some have relied on what they knew, others on being simply true. What worked for them might work for you. No memory of having starred atones for later disregard or keeps the end from being hard. Better to go down dignified with boughten friendship at your side than none at all. Provide, provide. Or as he was wont to say sometimes, or else somebody will provide for you, and how would you like that? Which is kind of the way that Robert Frost talked, by the way. A friend told me once that she was listening on public radio one time and was hearing this voice doing the poetry of Robert Frost, and said it was just awful. I mean, this man was butchering the poetry, had no sense of inflection or anything. Only when the reading was over did they say, this was an original recording of Robert Frost doing his own poetry. He wrote wonderfully. I mean, this poetry can be rendered orally, I think, in a wonderful way, but he wrote it, I think, more for the reading of it. Okay. Mending Wall is certainly one of Frost's most well-known poems, although probably the most frequently misquoted poem in all of the English language. This famous line, good fences make good neighbors, is often used to say, you know, we need our space, we need our boundaries. I've even seen, somebody sent me once an advertisement out of a magazine, some fence company, quoting this, you know, good fences make good neighbors. Well, they obviously had never read the poem, because it's not about that at all. He is wondering, why do we insist on setting up these dividing walls when really there's no point? This poem was written about a real-to-life experience when he had his farm in New Hampshire. He had a French-Canadian neighbor who lived over the hill from him. Napoleon Guy was his name. And they had this stone wall that separated the property. Now, you have to remember, not a stone wall like this that's all nicely, you know, cemented together, but these stone walls where you just simply pile the stones up one on the other. And he's musing about the fact that, if you notice, inevitably stones tend to roll off these walls. It's as if the wall is trying to bring itself down. But there is, as he said in There Are Roughly Zones, some limitless trait in the hearts of human beings that insists on putting these things back up. So why is that? Mending wall. Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that sends the frozen groundswell under it and spills the upper boulders in the sun and makes gaps that even two could pass abreast. Now, the work of hunters is another thing. I've come after them and made repair where they've left not one stone on a stone, but they would have the rabbit out of hiding to please the yelping dogs. The gaps, I mean, no one has seen them made or heard them made, but at spring mending time, we find them there. I let my neighbor know beyond the hill, and on a day we meet to walk the line and set the wall between us once again. To each the boulders that have fallen to each, and some are loaves and some so nearly balls, we have to use a spell to make them balance. Stay where you are till our backs are turned. Just another kind of outdoor game, one on a side, it comes to little more. There where it is, we do not need a wall. He is all pine tree, and I am apple orchard. My apple trees will never get across to eat the cones under his pines, I tell him. He only says, good fences make good neighbors. Spring is the mischief in me, and I wonder if I could put a notion in his head. Why do they make good neighbors? Isn't it where there are cows? But here we have no cows. Before I built a wall, I'd ask to know what I was walling in or walling out, and to whom I was like to give offense. Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that wants it down. I could say elves to him, but it isn't elves exactly, and I'd rather he said it for himself. I see him there, bringing a stone grasped firmly by the top in each hand like an old stone savage armed. He moves in darkness, as it seems to me, not of woods only and shade of trees, but he will not go behind his father's saying. And he likes having thought of it so well, he says again, good fences make good neighbors. Yeah. Well. Now, we do a 180, as Frost gives himself permission to do, after telling us, you know, you don't need walls and fences. here's a little poem called Trespass. Notice how his persona and character changes. He's reflecting, I think, on a real-to-life experience when he caught someone on his property. I've got to get in my right curmudgeonly mode here to make this poem come across right. No, I'd set no prohibiting sign. And yes, the land was hardly fenced. Nevertheless, the land was mine. I was being trespassed on and against. Whoever the surly freedom took of such an unaccountable stay, busying by my woods and brook, gave me a strangely restless day. He might be opening leaves of stone, the picture book of the trilobite, for which the region round was known, and in which there is little property right. This is not the value I stood to lose in specimen crab or specimen rock, but his ignoring what was whose that made me look again at the clock. Then came his little acknowledgement. He asked for a drink at the kitchen door, an errand he may have had to invent, but it made my property mine once more. So. Well, we head down the home stretch here with just a few more poems. Take something like a star. Again, he's talking to, we had him, talking to bugs and flowers and so forth. He's talking to a star. He wants something eternal out of this star. He wants advice. He wants something, as he says, that we can learn by heart and when alone repeat. Something timeless. I don't know if you've ever had this experience, you know, being with someone who you thought was just full of wisdom and would tell you the meaning of life, only to find that the advice was really rather mundane. This is the kind of experience he's having here. Take something like a star. O star, the fairest one in sight, we grant your loftiness the right to some obscurity of cloud. It will not do to say of night, for dark is what brings out your light. Some mystery becomes the proud. But to be wholly taciturn in your reserve is not allowed. Say something to us we can learn by heart, and when alone, repeat. Say something. And it says, I burn. But say with what degree of heat, talk Fahrenheit, talk centigrade, use language we can comprehend, tell us what elements you blend. It gives us strangely little aid, but does say something in the end. And steadfast as Keats' Eremite, not even stooping from its sphere, it asks a little of us here. It asks of us a certain height. So when at times the mob is swayed to carry praise or blame too far, we might take something like a star to stay our minds on and be stayed. Why not? Well, there are two poems now without which you could not call any presentation of Robert Frost complete without sharing these, The Road Not Taken and Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening. It was a long time into my working with The Road Not Taken before I finally realized that you don't know whether he is happy or not with the choice that's been made. This poem is often used to say, you know, do the adventuresome thing, take the road not taken. There you will find your heart's desire. Frost is not so facile. He leaves it entirely up to us to decide in the end whether this has been or has not been the proper choice. In that way, he invites us into the poem, which I think is very much his genius. You must participate and make the decisions along with the poet. The road not taken. Two roads diverged in a yellow wood. And sorry, I could not travel both and be one traveler. Long I stood and looked down one as far as I could to where it bent in the undergrowth. And then took the other as just as fair, and having perhaps the better claim, because it was grassy and wanted wear, though, as for that, the passing there had worn them really about the same. And both that morning equally lay in leaves, no step had trodden black. I saved the first for another day, yet knowing how way leads on to way, I doubted if I should ever come back. I shall be telling this tale with a sigh somewhere, ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the road less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. Well, and that perhaps leads you into the snowy woods, stopping by woods on a snowy evening. Frost was fond of saying that poems were written, as he called it, in a state of grace. And he told the story about this poem that it was written after he had been up all night writing a very long narrative poem called New Hampshire, which is interesting in its own right. The last verse, he said, after a long description of New Hampshire, he writes, "'Tis pleasant to be thinking of New Hampshire. At present, I'm living in Vermont." Anyway, he told this story about how after he'd written this poem, he came outside and the snow was gently falling. It's 5 a.m. or something. And he said it came to him, this poem of stopping by woods on a snowy evening. Well, as the truth is really the case, it was later discovered that in the archives at the University of Michigan, which is the repository for much of Frost's poetry, he was on faculty there for a long time, there are actually 3 or 4 or 5 existing versions of this poem. He apparently tinkered with it a good bit till he got it just the way he wanted. It was not written in a state of grace. It was slaved over until he found just exactly the right rhyme scheme that he wanted. But in its final version, I think we'd all have to agree, it's a real thing of beauty, stopping by woods on a snowy evening. Whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though he will not see me stopping here to watch his woods fill up with snow. My little horse must think it queer to stop without a farmhouse near between the woods and frozen lake, the darkest evening of the year. He gives his harness bells a shake to ask if there is some mistake. The only other sounds, the sweep of easy wind and downy flake. The woods are lovely, dark and deep, but I have promises to keep and miles to go before I sleep, and miles to go before I sleep. Well, we started off with a little love poem, that poem, The Pasture, and I want to close with one that maybe frames the experience. It happens to be one of my wife's favorites, so this is for her. Also for her because she is much better as a Greek scholar than I am. And this poem is called Iota Subscript. I have to know just a little bit about Greek to get the point here. In Greek, sometimes the letter I, iota, is dropped out of the word and becomes a little slash mark under another letter. It's called iota subscript. It was a space-saving device, I guess. In fact, you'll notice if you take a look at this little book here, David Martin did the calligraphy on the front. Every place where there was an I, he has dropped it out and made it a little subscripted I. It's a nice touch because that poem is in here. Iota subscript, he's reflecting on the letter I, that personal pronoun, and how interesting it is that in Greek that slides out of the word and becomes subscripted, as it were, subservient to others. Now, I would say none of us, certainly not I, not me, can claim to live out what this poem presents to us fully. But I think it's an aspiration. It's a way to want to live, a way to want to be in relationship, certainly a way I would like to be in marriage. I know that I'm not always, and my wife will tell you that. But it's a goal worthy of striving for. Yoda subscript. Seek not in me the big I capital, nor the little dotted in me seek. If I have in me any I at all, 'tis the Yoda subscript of the Greek. So small am I as an attention beggar that the letter I am subscript to is neither Alpha, Eta, nor Omega, but Upsilon, which is the Greek for you. Yeah. And finally, the epitaph. This is part of a longer poem. I'm not going to do the whole thing. It's called The Lesson for Today. But if you go to Bennington, Vermont, in a churchyard there, you can see where Frost is buried. Anne and I have been there. And this is actually written on his gravestone, this epitaph. Were an epitaph to be my story, I'd have a short one ready of my own. I would have written of me on my stone, he had a lover's quarrel with the world. And indeed he did. I thank you for coming, for sharing this poetry.